I ran across an old news story this week that made me feel happy. Well, at least that's sort of how it started. It made me feel happy, and then some other emotions showed up. We'll kind of get to that. But running across a news story that makes me feel happy felt unusual enough, so that seemed like, you know, a good starting place. And when I hit one that elicits that other reaction, the happiness reaction, because bad news sells so much better than good news, and so it's just everywhere. So when I hit one of these other stories, I feel like I really need to stop. I need to pay attention. I need to ruminate about this a little bit. I want it to stick. I don't remember, know who to credit this to. It's become bumper sticker already, but in our culture. But bad news is Velcro, good news is Teflon. That idea, right? We have to spend time with the things that are positive or they don't stick, but the bad stuff is like. So when I hit a good one, I want to pay attention. And then to make this all even more remarkable to me, it's an American news story. I feel like American news stories that make me feel happier in very short supply. And then what really sent it over the top for me was that it's an American religious news story. How many American religious news stories have I run across that made me feel happy? Super short list. It also made me really uncomfortable. It made me squirm because it took me back to some aspects of my own religious tradition of origin that I no longer resonate with, that when I bump into them today, they feel like what we were talking about a moment ago, like I just need to leave that there. That's not coming home with me. And as it turned out, there were things for me to learn both in the happiness of this encounter with this story and in the discomfort. That's sort of how it goes, isn't it? More on that shortly, but what I want us to do, first of all, is just watch a little clip of this story and sort of let some of the media stuff from it tell the story sort of for itself.
I'll never forget the morning that I saw an article about a group of Muslims who had bought 30 acres and were planning to build a complex. When I saw that, my stomach kind of tightened up. They were going to be right across the street from us. I felt that ignorance and that fear. So I prayed. I said, Lord, what are we supposed to do?
The idea of Memphis Islamic Center started because we felt we needed a family life center, a place for people to pray and play, to socialize, and have a sense of community. It is a difficult time for Muslims in America. We did not expect to be welcomed. We thought we have to work hard. And one day we were driving by and we see a banner. And that banner says,
Heartsong Church welcomes the Memphis Islamic Center to the neighborhood.
Me and my wife both were thinking about leaving church because I just did not accept what was going on.
Lord, we are so humble.
I went to Pastor Steve and asked him, I said, what are we doing? He told me to read the Gospels. When I read through those Gospels and I figured out I was the problem. What was going on with the world today? I was the problem.
And then we started building. The month of fasting, the month of Ramadan, was supposed to be our grand opening day where we start praying here, and it was clear that we were not going to have our hall ready.
We got a call, and Bashar said, we just wondered if we could use your building for our prayers.
In case we don't get our permit in time. Instead of using the room for a few nights, we ended up spending the entire month of Ramadan at Heartsong Church. Ramadan brought us much closer. People started knowing each other on a personal level.
We had done coat drives and food drives, and close to 9/11, we do a blood drive together.
I would have never thought that I would be friends with Muslims.
Right here.
And I love it. It's kind of like my world got bigger.
We are better congregation now. We are better people because of this friendship with Heartsong.
It's an amazing friendship that I can't imagine having missed out on.
How's everybody doing today? Well, cheer louder if you're having fun.
One of the things I appreciate about this particular story is that it has had a bit of a ripple effect. It's touched on in the video itself, but it's worth remembering that all of this happened in post 9/11 America. So this is like a 2016 story, I think was actually the date on the byline. And that would be a time when it would be fair to say that Dr. Bashar Shalala's characterization of "it's a difficult time to be a Muslim in America" was pretty masterful understatement. The story made national news in the States, which meant that it was on CNN, which meant, and here's the world we live in, which meant that a group of Muslims in a small town in Kashmir, India, saw it on their TVs and heard an interview with this pastor, with Steve Stone. And after hearing an interview with this guy, one of the Muslim leaders said, quote, "God just spoke to us through this man." Another one from that community went straight to their local Christian church, cleaned it inside and out. And the group together sent a message to Stone in which one of the Kashmiri men wrote, quote, "We are now trying to be good neighbors too. Tell your congregation we do not hate them. We love them. And for the rest of our lives, we're going to take care of that church." So, that's an interesting story, hey? Well, the Memphis Islamic Center got built, but these two communities work together every month to help the homeless in their neighborhood and to continue to develop what they're calling a friendship park. It's actually a fairly, like a multi-million dollar initiative that they're working over year by year, but it's like a big park that actually crosses the boundaries, the legal boundaries of both properties, ties them together, shared by both the properties. Some pretty great stuff going on there. Very intentional blurring of the boundaries between those two religious communities. It's a pretty beautiful thing. The fact that they share Thanksgiving together, I'm sure the editor kind of went, this is too good to pass up, but it was the pork. That kind of, right, the big old flomp, you know, of barbecued pork that made me go, oh man, like everybody's given some ground here in a way that's pretty lovely. And then the thing that clinched it for me was them doing a blood drive in the dates post 9/11 every year. And the shot of those two shots of the two young pairs of young guys, you know, Muslim and not Muslim, side by side, both kind of like, yep. And I thought, yeah, we breathe the same, we bleed the same, right? Like, this is just something so good going on here. And at the root of that story, one of the things I see is this reminder that nobody really cares what I believe unless they actually believe that I care. Like, it just, who cares, you know? But I think that that it's easy for us in this age to think that the kind of rearranging of the furniture of ideas is of great consequence. And it's not of no consequence, but it's of relatively little consequence if that rearrangement of our ideas doesn't also rearrange our priorities and our actions. And this particular story has as one of its central features some buildings, the already established Hartsong Community or Hartsong Church, and then at the point of the story, this only dreamed of Memphis Islamic Center, a place to pray and play. I thought that was nicely captured. The things that we build, the things that we put our time and our effort and our money into, they matter to us as a species. They're probably one of the most easily seen ways that we make worlds of the earth, that we make symbols of lots of things. Our buildings symbolize lots of things, things that range from, I would say, humility and kindness to ignorance and hubris. You know, like we make a lot of different kind of symbols when we make buildings. And people that want to help us imagine a better world have often turned to this metaphor of buildings to help us picture the good possibilities. Shortly before he was murdered, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote this: "We have inherited a large house, a great world house in which we have to live together, black and white, Easterner and Westerner, Gentile and Jew, Catholic and Protestant, Muslim and Hindu, a family unduly separated in ideas, cultures, and interest, who, because we can never again live apart, must somehow learn to live with each other in peace." King was assassinated just over 50 years ago, And when I think about his words, separate quote, he said, "We must learn to live together as brothers or perish as fools." When I think about those words, I sometimes think that the fools are winning. But then I bump into a story like this and, you know, my hope kind of wells back up. Or I hear a song like Crowded Table, which we've recently begun to sing together here, the chorus of which says, "I want a house with a crowded table and a place by the fire for everyone. Let us take on the world while we're young and able and bring us back together when the day is done." One of the reasons that song impacts me personally and has from the first time I heard it is because the lead songwriter on that tune is Brandi Carlile. Brandi is part of a same-sex marriage. They have two fabulous little girls. And she's somebody that knows what it's like to have to fight for a place at the table. It's a generous-spirited song because given some of Brandy's story, she could just as well have written a chorus that said something like, "I want a house with a tiny table, a place by the fire for me and mine. Let's close out the world and ignore our neighbor and die apart from others when the day is done." Clearly, she's a better songwriter than I am. And if those were my convictions, I'd say she's also a better human being. I want to spin this crowded house, crowded table metaphor out a little bit this morning. When we moved to this new home, new to us home, this spring, the place we bought came with all kinds of sort of left behind objects. A little bit of an abandoned situation, I think, in some ways. A couple of the nicer pieces the previous owner left behind were two windows, relatively new, sort of modern design, synthetic frame, sealed pane windows. They were just stashed in the garage. Said garage is right on the border of a left-behind object, I would say. Pretty old building, pretty terrible windows. So that got me thinking, I could probably swap these out. You know, like, I've got windows, I need windows. Good. But the new windows are bigger, and so they just wouldn't, like, pop into the old openings, which got me on a bit of a research project about determining window height. Now, I know there are people in this room who could just answer this question. Just stay with me. This isn't going to be a construction story in the end, but just hang in there. So I'm doing this research. I'm reading about window heights. How do you establish the height of a window when you just have an option? And I'm reading about window height in garages in particular, because that's my project. And lots of the threads that I'm bumping into are guys. So my new neighbor walks into this garage, looks around, and just starts talking man cave. Like, what is it about guys in garages? Anyway, there's mostly guys on these threads. And they're mostly saying things like, "When I was building my garage, I mounted my garage windows up high so my neighbors couldn't see in, or so they couldn't tell when I was in there at night, or so they couldn't see what I was." I'm like, "What are you making in your garage, man? Like, you got it so my grow-op wouldn't bother my neighbors." Anyway, this is sort of the theme, right? I abandoned ship. But anyway, it wasn't really helpful when it comes to the project. But all that kind of reading did get me thinking about what I would regard as a more important question than, you know, what height should I put the garage windows? But since I've already been going on about windows, I'm going to start there. So in thinking about this question of the characteristics of a crowded house, what kind of house has a crowded table? I'm going to suggest that a crowded house is one that isn't afraid to mount its windows low. I want to work with that metaphor a little bit, which is another way, I think, of saying no secrets here. It's a way of thinking about the life of the occupants being invitational rather than hidden or exclusive, inclusive rather than exclusive. It's a way of saying that there is light inside of this house that we want to let out, and there is light outside of this house that we want to let in. If we push the metaphor even a little bit, I think we pretty quickly bump into ideas about shame and guilt, about image, about identity, all these sorts of things that thematically sort of foster hiddenness. Religion of all sorts, I think, like other human institutions, kind of has an internal gravity of self-preservation. That's a kind of gravity. Self-preservation is a kind of gravity that feeds on fear. And fear is a human characteristic that feeds on secrets. So given how many of us as humans apparently have symptoms of imposter disorder, you know, this feeling that if the people around us really know who we were, we'd be exposed as fraudulent, maybe it shouldn't be a surprise that when we make institutions that behave in similar ways, right? But what if we chose otherwise? What if we mounted our windows low to the ground, so to speak, as a way of saying, go ahead and look. Might not be pretty. You're for sure going to see things that need to change. But it's who we are. It's how we live. And if we're going to have anything like an authentic dialogue, that's where we need to start. Not with hiddenness. By the way, I think it's how we live is what we really want to know about one another. And even when we don't want to know that about one another, I'm going to suggest that it's what we need to know about one another. How we live matters way more than what we say we believe. In Out of Africa, which was a memoir well before it was a movie, author Karen Blixen tells a story about a young boy named Katao who appears at her door in Nairobi one day and asks if he can work for her. She hires him on the spot, and he does a great job caring for things around her household. And so she's a little bit distressed when after only 3 months in the job, he comes to her and says he wants her to write a letter of reference for him, a letter of recommendation to a Muslim who lives in Mombasa named Sheikh Ali. She doesn't want to lose him, so she offers to raise his pay, but he's pretty determined. Nope. He's going, and would she please write this letter of reference, recommendation? So she pushes into it a little bit. She wants to know what's going on. And he tells her he's decided to become either a Christian or a Muslim. And his whole purpose in coming to live with her was to see the ways and the habits of a Christian up close, and now he wanted to go live with Sheikh Ali for 3 months and see how Muslims lived and behaved, and then he was going to make up his mind. And Blixen is aghast. And this is what she writes about it. She writes, I believe that even an archbishop, when he had had these facts laid before him, would have said, or at least thought, as I said, good God, Katao, you might have told me that when you came here. I think we all get it, right? Like, this is the part of us that looks around the room and lowers our voice before we say certain things to one another, right? Like, we get that. We're used to having our windows high in the wall, so not just anyone can see in. And maybe when it comes to religion, this is why we like our boundary markers so much, right? Maybe we could understand this a little more if we think about why we might vet someone else's spirituality with questions about doctrine or dogma rather than having open conversations with one another about how we actually live. I don't know if you've had this experience, being grilled on your beliefs. With questions like, you know, do you believe in the virgin birth and physical resurrection? Do you believe the Bible's the inerrant word of God? Do you believe Jesus is the only way to God? Kind of that whole set of questions. Some of you know that whole set of questions. It's kind of a classic list. It's often, by the way, that list is often regarded as Christian orthodoxy. Curious fact, not one of those items that I just mentioned is germane to first century Christianity. Like, not one of those dogmas have their roots in first century Christianity. They are all lifted verbatim from an early 20th century document published by the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, who in the early 20th century published a series of essays to establish what they understood to be the fundamentals of Christian belief. Early 20th century. Yeah, let's get close to the source, okay? But we could think of those as high window questions. Those are the kind of questions that are designed to vet who gets to look in and who doesn't. They're designed to decide who's an insider and who's an outsider, and they're predicated on an exclusive perspective on religion that treats right belief as the judge and jury of who gets to look in and be in and who doesn't. Well, let's contrast that for a minute, because that might be all fine and good as a metaphor, but what is a low window question sound like? Maybe it sounds more like, how does what you believe, whatever that is, change the way that you live? What did you find hardest? What do you find hardest about loving your neighbor as yourself? The most commonly held belief when it comes to religious beliefs. How do you connect with the divine? These are questions about the way we live. They're the kind of questions that can begin to open our minds and our hearts and our lives to the other, to the one that Jesus called our neighbor. In the final event, our beliefs are just things we say unless they lead us to things we actually do. They're just a sentence. Which is why I think the low window questions are so important, because they're about how we live. One more building metaphor to kind of send us on our way here. I think that a house with a crowded table is one that not only does the courageous thing of putting its windows low, but I think it's a house that considers its doors a way to let people in, not a way to keep people out. Tricky idea. Let me illustrate some of the tension in that this way. I was in the middle, actually, like, I wrote that sentence, my phone was sitting on my desk, and it buzzed with a text. So I looked at the text, and it was from a friend who had just had someone show up at their door claiming to be a private investigator and accusing them of election fraud. So just take a moment. Think about that experience. Knock, knock, knock. Hello. Well, they responded, I think, really sagely, and as I hope most of us would, they took a picture of the person's ID, they told them to leave, they made a police report, and they called Elections Canada to see what was up. This friend is a young adult female, they live alone. So as this story kind of unspooled on my phone, I sent them a question. I said, how are you feeling about the safety of your home under the circumstances? And they replied, quote, a bit wobbly. Well, I guess so. It's experiences like that, or even awareness of them, experiences where we feel threatened, where we feel like the defensive reason we have doors and windows. It's experiences like that that can prompt us to, you know, mount the windows high and lock the doors. I don't want to be blithe about that in any way. By way of contrast, I know what it's like. I have the good fortune, I have the privilege of knowing what it's like to live in a neighborhood where I have a relationship of trust with, in the case of the neighborhood where we lived for the last 15 years, with all of my neighbors, such that I would not only not feel like I needed to lock my door, but I would ask them to come and go through the place if I'm going to be gone for a while. Trust is the ground that safety grows in. We can't grow trust if we think we're the only ones in the story with something that is legitimately precious. It's not an invitation to be unwise, but it is an invitation to risk being open-hearted. It's not an invitation to be heedless, but it is an invitation to be open-minded. There's always tension in these things. They will never be simple. When it comes to religion, I think often those sort of right belief questions are experienced as door closed unless you know the password kinds of questions. It's the human questions about someone else's lived experience that open the door and that invite us to share our lives with one another. I think I could count them on one hand, instances where I have asked a lived experience sort of question of a stranger and been met with something other than some version of more or less happy surprise. And I mean, some sensitivity is important. But my goodness, I just, over and over again, I'm astonished when we ask because we actually want to know what someone's lived experience is. My mind has been blown so many times by what people just open up and say. Just like, whoosh, like right away. I think inside we know that this is the world we want to live in. But we're surrounded by messages that say, that's not a livable world, it's too dangerous. You're gonna hear the wrong thing. You're gonna end up believing something that's gonna ruin you. Surrounded by these messages of fear and enclosure. Some of us come from a tradition, a religious tradition, that seems to have lost the plot when it comes to being open to the wind of spirit blowing both in and out of the windows. To having the traffic of an inspired life both coming and going. To being part of life in a house with a table that is crowded, and is crowded because there's room for everyone. And that's kind of irresistible. Next week, Judy's taking the talk a bit. She's nodding. That means I got the information right, at least, so that's good. We're going to come back to this a little bit. And somewhere in here, Wally's going to take a talk a bit, too, and we're still working on the date, so that might happen in the next couple of weeks. Not sure which week will be which, but really looking forward to that as well. But when we do come back to this, what I want to do is I want to explore a bit of how that idea of the wind of spirit blowing both in and out of religious houses, if you wish, that idea is strong in the teachings of Jesus. And I'm going to suggest that it's not strong in that 20th century list that says, here's the teachings of Jesus and all the other ones are a problem, but that it's strong when we get as close as we can to what Jesus had to say as people heard it in the first century. It's really pretty interesting stuff. For now, I'm just going to leave us with a quote from Desmond Tutu, a contemporary wise person. Tutu wrote this on this general matter. God is clearly not a Christian. I'm already feeling better about where this is going, you know? God is clearly not a Christian. His concern is for all his children. That Christians do not have a monopoly on God is almost trite observation. What if there are ways to live a life of spiritual invitation, a life where we can set our hearts on something that is so good and also so big, so expansive, that it shows us a good path for everyday life and welcomes those whose life looks nothing like ours? I think there are lots of ways that could happen. But since the Jesus tradition is the one that I know best, that's the one that I'm going to return to when we kind of pick that examination up, whether that's, you know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks from now. But in the meantime, let's look forward to what Judy's going to bring to us as a community and what Wally's going to bring to us as a community and what we bring to one another as a community. And when we open the doors and the windows of this place to the good breath that blows out of this community, as well as the good breath that we can welcome into this community. Peace.